Call this meeting back to order and kind of amazed how many people in the audience. Welcome. Very glad to see you. Sorry we're a little late. We had a committee meeting that ran over a bit. But we're back and ready to have our fourth item on our agenda, which is our open public input. A number of people have signed up to testify. And I always go through what the commission rules are so everyone understands, and we ask for your compliance. The commission gives each individual 3 minutes to testify. We'd like you to come up to the front table, speak fairly close to the mic, and when you hear the beeping noise, that means your time is up, and we'd like you to conclude. And if you just keep on talking, I will interrupt and remind you your time is up. And so we'll go ahead. I know that some people have asked to testify together, so if you're in that group, just let me know. But first person who signed up is Ed Tharp. You in the audience? Okay, come forward, please, and take one of the seats at the front table in front of a microphone. And in fact, so that we can move this along, because we didn't anticipate this number of people, Lyle Cabe, would you come forward too? Get ready to testify. Okay, Mr. Tharp?
Yeah, couple of items that weren't on it that I feel that from being out in the field, there's a couple of things I've noticed, and there's a couple of other deals that I've had other people wanted to bring up, but they just can't work into their work schedules. Number one, I was out bird hang on one of the local hunting cunning areas, and we had the grasses, some of the grass was up to as tall as I am. Now, like on some of these farm plots where we have that kind of stuff, if we can take some of that, maybe harvest some of that grass or some of, or put some crops in there for the elk feeding programs, help supplement with the alfalfa hay that they're using, that would probably help cut down some of the costs. And and then too, they could do it so they could still have the a percentage of game cover for later on in when the hunting seasons come in and protect birds through the winter. One thing on there is a lot of us have quit hunting is because you have to pick a weapon and stay with that weapon. That puts a hardship on a lot of us because, like, sometimes some of us can't get out into the stuff where the animals are not in the areas. And then when you get to another season, then they're available for the other season, but they're not available for this other stuff. And then, too, for some of us with health or disability effects, trying to get into some of that backcountry, that would affect in on that weapon selection. Because some guys can't get out there and hunt with a bow, or some of them can't hunt with a rifle because of disability effects. Okay, and then opening up some of the game land for other types of activities like rock hunting or using the planes and stuff if they can do it, or going out and having access to it where they can maybe just go swimming and stuff like that. Some of the areas are kind of touchy. And then on the some of the DNR land too, I know that it overlaps. And that That was more or less my main concern.
Thank you. Thank you for testimony. Okay. Jerry Lowe, would you come forward? Hey, Mr. Cape.
Madam Chair, Commission members, good afternoon. My name is Lyle Cabe, and I'm a lifelong resident, fisherman and hunter of the state of Washington. I'm here to express my alarm concerning the white sturgeon stock in the lower Columbia River. There are several people here today that share my concern, and in the interest of time, with your permission, I'd like to have them stand during my comments instead of each repeating my concerns. Would that be okay?
Sure.
Okay.
You want to...
I have fished the Columbia River for decades, and it's been a lot of fun to take my boat down below Beacon Rock and anchor it, or off the mouth of the Sandy River, or on Terminal 6 across from the Port of Vancouver and fish for sturgeon. Sturgeon fishing was fun because there would be a lot of action, fish biting all day long. Getting several dozen bites during the day would keep the attention of any young folks that you take with you. You never knew if the bite would be from an 8-foot oversized or a 4-foot keeper, or even a 2-foot sublegal sturgeon would keep things interesting. Times have changed. Current creel counts are dismal. The fish just are not there, and most alarming is a shortage of sublegal sturgeon being hooked. You can surmise from the lack of effort in the lower Columbia River by sport fishermen that sturgeon fishing just isn't fun anymore. Along with the lack of fishing effort, this results in a significant effect on the economies in the lower 144 miles of the Columbia River. I have read in department staff reports that creel counts are highly regarded in determining the health of the sturgeon stock. The recent creel counts should alarm you as they do me. I don't know if a shortage of sturgeon in the lower river is a result of lack of food or sea lion predation or over harvest. You can't do much about bringing the smelt back or the preventing the stellar sea lions from killing brood stock, but we can have an effect on over harvest. My question is, how long are we going to chase the sturgeon stock numbers into the toilet before we do something dynamic to try and save them? Do you have a trigger point to change the status quo, or are we going to stand by year after year and use the same harvest rate and see next year's numbers go even lower? It is time to change our sturgeon philosophy. Thank you for the time.
Thank you.
Okay.
Commissioner Duvia.
Sir?
Yes. I'm sorry?
You referenced a dynamic change in sturgeon policy. Did you have something in mind?
Yes, I do. The harvest rate has been 22.5% for years, and each time that is applied to the harvest rate, it needs to be reduced. There needs to be some reduction in harvest, and one way would be to the winter sturgeon gillnet fishery is one way. Those fish can be caught later in the year as bycatch. And it seems a shame to send, you know, the commercial fishermen out into the river during this early season when there's wild steelhead in there. I know they use 9-inch mesh nets, but they still are stressing the sturgeon and other bycatch.
And something dynamic on the recreational side, if we had to do something for a year or two.
If it needs to be reduced also, then if that's what needs to happen, you folks have seen the reduction year after year after year in the stock in the river. And if it has to be, the sport fishing has to be reduced also. We need to get rebuilding the stock instead of continually chasing those numbers downstream. And if it takes a reduction in sport fishing also, I think the sport fishers would agree with that.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
We've got quite a few more people to listen to. The sturgeon issue is on our agenda for later this afternoon, so there'll be plenty of time for Q&A at that. Can I ask the commission to defer questions until then? Yeah, that's true. So if you'd like to, Commissioner Jennings, go ahead.
And I will be brief. I just wanted to say, thank you for your comments. Several members of the commission, I don't want to speak for all of them, recognize that we think we have a certain problem, and coming to the table the way you did, being willing to make sacrifices from your perspective on take, really makes our job easier to manage, as opposed to having the issue of we see there's a problem, we're trying to make reductions, and being fought about that. So thank you for coming to us with a clear attitude about how do we work together to make things better.
Great. Thank you. Commissioner Carpenter.
Very briefly, having lived in Klamath some years back and very aware of the smelt situation on the Cowlitz and the Klamath River, I don't know if I should ask staff or one of this gentleman just spoke. What is the linkage or correlation between the die-off or failed returns of the smelt and the situation with the sturgeon?
Commissioner Mencken.
Yeah, I want to compliment you on your presentation and echo what Commissioner Jennings has said. This commission is concerned about the condition that our white sturgeon population is in the Columbia River. We value your input and any suggestions that you would have as to the specifics of how you would change that fishery, we'd be interested in hearing. Thank you.
Okay, Harry Barber, would you come forward? Okay, Mr. Lowe. And is this the group that we've got two more? We'll need some more chairs if you all want to. Okay.
Good one, ma'am. My name is Jerry Lowe. I'm a commercial fisherman from Westport. I'll shorten this up as much as I can. First, I'd like to address your point. We're all concerned about the sturgeon. Everybody's concerned about the sturgeon, and everybody knows they're in trouble. I think the department has a grip on this, and we're working on it. That 22% seems to be fine to me. But as far as your sturgeon or your smelt question goes, you know, maybe not. But anyway, the sturgeon in the Bonneville Pool are doing pretty good. The sturgeon are spreading out more. There's sturgeon in the ocean, quite a few sturgeon in the ocean. How many is debatable. We've got sturgeon in Puget Sound that are coming from the Columbia River. We know they go to Sacramento, the Fraser River, and we know they're in trouble. Probably my solution to help the sturgeon would be to quit killing the babies. We have to decide what is a baby. What's an undersized sturgeon? We have 43 inches, 38 inches in between somewhere. These guys are also concerned about the sturgeon. Let's join together and go to a 43-inch baby. Anything under that's a baby. Quit being baby killers. Let's let these fish grow up. Give them a chance. The sportsmen already have 80% of the available harvest, but they're taking the babies. They're not getting into the window. As far as one of the things that's been brought up here is the value of the sturgeon, and this is one of the for the most part I really support the department. But the biggest thing I have against the department is that, and when trying to put a value on commercial fishing, we use the X vessel price, which is totally meaningless. It doesn't mean anything. But it just gives you an indication. But that's it. Right now, sturgeon is available here in Olympia for $17 a pound. That's what these fish are worth. That's roughly three times the price of a prime rib. In summary, I'd like to say that it's very important to spread the available harvest that we have. If we're going to harvest the fish, it's important to spread it out as much as possible. We need the winter fishery. We need all the fishery, little fisheries we can, whether it's bycatch or targeted catch is anybody's guess. Some of the fishermen target sturgeon, some of them target salmon. Nobody targets steelhead.
Okay.
As far as ESA fish goes, we're going to be living with that forever. We all know that. It isn't going to matter whether it's salmon or steelhead or, you know, hopefully it won't be sturgeon. We got the green sturgeon now. There's always we're never going to get away from it. This is the 21st century. There's always going to be a stream somewhere that's in trouble. Somebody will bring up. So we just have to live with that. And we can live with it, with selective fishing. The commercial fishermen are the more selective. All right, thanks.
Thank you. Ed Wickersham, you want to take this empty seat now? And Mr. Barber?
Yeah. Madam Chair, members of the Commission and staff, I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify once more about the plight of Columbia River Sturgeon in the Lower River. This will be the third year that we have testified here. I am a volunteer with CCA. And you have a packet, and I would like you to please look at the left-hand side of your packet and pull out a graph. The graph looks like this. I am kind of a data head, and I like to speak with data. In this case, I'm using primarily the department's data. This graph represents sturgeon abundance of the legal population from 1996 through projection through 2012. You can see back in 1997, there were 174,000 legal-sized fish. If you fast forward to 2010, where we just got the results back for the what's called the historic method of the population estimate, the population has fallen to 66,400. That's a drop of 62%. In 13 years. That should be a concern to us all. If you look at, say, 97 to 2007, it looks like the population is somewhat plateaued, and you can be lulled into complacency saying, well, gee, that doesn't look so bad. The problem is, during most of that period, we had an objective to grow the legal size population. We didn't grow it. We barely kept it constant. Starting in 2007, a very dramatic decline in the population, and this is in spite of strong guideline reductions that were spearheaded by the Commission, and we thank you for your leadership in that effort. There was a 40% reduction in the guideline in 2010, followed by a 30% reduction in the harvest guideline in 2011. In spite of those dramatic guideline reductions, the population continues to drop. I go back to what Lyle Cave said. I think one of the root causes is that we continue to harvest at 22.5% OSY, exploitation rate. We just can't harvest at that rate. Too many other factors are affecting the population, including pinniped predation, and we have a very poor estimate of what the number of recruits are going into the legal population each year. There's probably 40% of the legal population are recruits, and we have very wide confidence intervals around that recruitment number. If you look at the point estimate using the old method, the 66,400, the confidence interval is plus 37,900, minus 21,000. It's a huge interval. Now the departments, leading with Oregon's lead, have gone to what's called the set line method for estimating population. And this is a key point. That set line projection method, number one, gives a higher estimate, considerably higher than what the historical method has predicted, and it has a confidence interval that's greater than plus or minus 69%. I mean, I think it's just insanity to make believe we have a population point estimate and we're going to apply a 22% harvest rate or a 16% harvest rate against the point estimate that has got plus or minus 69% confidence interval. There needs to be a significant buffer, say a 30% buffer, applied to any a point estimate.
Thank you. Ms. Ross? Jenny Ross? Okay. Ed?
If that's okay, Madam Chair?
Sure.
Okay. Good afternoon. Madam Chair, members of the Commission, I'm Ed Wickersham. Here with CCA Washington. I'm here to identify management problems and suggest some corrective actions to help with this Lower Columbia River sturgeon declines. The first action we must take is to simply uphold existing policy. Currently, Lower Columbia River sturgeon management policy holds that WDFW should increase the abundance of legal-sized sturgeon. That's been in place for some years. They need to maintain the 80-20 sports commercial allocation division, and they need to provide sufficient sturgeon spawning sanctuaries or other protection measures when and where appropriate. Unfortunately, we are failing on all three of those policies I've outlined. In Harry's previous testimony, we saw how excessive harvest rates on falling and uncertain populations have undoubtedly caused failure to meet this first objective. One harvest element that should be immediately ended is the winter-directed sturgeon gillnet season. The fishery should be canceled permanently. It has little participation, questionable economic value, and leads to unnecessary handle later in the season, since the entire commercial sturgeon harvest can easily be taken later in the year as bycatch and directed salmon fisheries. This season harms ESA-listed salmon and steelhead with no mitigating measures. With no monitoring, we have no reliable data for understanding the actual cost of this fishery to sturgeon or ESA-listed salmon and steelhead. Participation in this season increases significantly when spring chinook are available, so it is doubtful that it's even truly a sturgeon season. As for the second objective, we are falling farther and farther away from the 80-20 allocation split. We're now more like 75-25. The allocation must be brought back in line with policy. Concerning the third objective, we want to alert you to a problem involving gillnet harvest in the 9-mile broodstock sanctuary that is downstream of Bonneville Dam. This area is closed to all recreational sturgeon fishing from May through August to reduce sturgeon broodstock mortality. This sanctuary was requested by the department. Last year, the agency allowed 10 days of gillnetting within the sanctuary and 8 days the year before, both with sturgeon sales permitted. This occurred despite the area being closed to all recreational sturgeon fishing. This gillnet fishery potentially handles thousands of sturgeon and hundreds of broodstock with no consistent monitoring. All gillnetting within that sanctuary should be stopped immediately. The other couple of points I want to make is that we need to look at the lack of mortality rate assumptions. We hear talk from certain parts of the community that there's no mortality on sturgeon. I'd ask you to look in your pamphlets at the pictures of those sturgeon and the injuries they have and ask yourself if really we have no mortality on sturgeon. With that, I can finish, and thank you very much for the opportunity to comment.
Thank you. Ms. Ross?
Thank you, commissioners, for having us here today. And I'm Ginny Ross, a volunteer with CCA Washington. My job is to just summarize some of our action items, which I just want to alert you to our executive summary that kind of gives you just a point-by-point action list for the points that we think are the most important to take right now. And, of course, first and foremost is the harvest rate. And Harry summarized well. There's a single-page summary of his discussion here as well to refer to, but it's important to understand that the harvest rate of the past, or we hope will be passed, 22.5%, is based on everything being okay and populations being stable and such, and we certainly don't have that situation now. Next, we do hope to see the end of this winter-directed sturgeon's gillnet season. The allocation needs to be restored, and also please finish or equalize the treatment of the broodstock sanctuary between the both fisheries. I'd like to just point out a historical precedent. Sturgeon has suffered in the past, and in the late 80s dropped to all-time lows for that period. And so there's a precedent. At that time, no sturgeon fisheries were allowed for the gillnet fleet. And 10 years later or so, populations rebounded. So that was an 8-year period with no commercial sturgeon-directed openings. Sets a clear precedent for now ending the current directed season, and we think that that would be a good step. Finally, I'd just like to reiterate what Ed brought up, that regulations need to be revisited for how sturgeon are handled and whether any improvements can be made in handle, both on the sport and on the commercial side, and that to help with this, consistent monitoring and daytime fishing requirements would be best. Thank you for hearing us today. We appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thank you all. Commissioner Duvia?
Thanks, Madam Chair. Ed, I was curious if on the this winter gill netting season, if you have what the numbers are that you feel is being taken.
Well, from the department's website last year, I believe there were 50 sturgeon taken.
55.
Okay, 55. And I think 80-some spring chinook. And that's from the department's website on commercial landings.
Thank you.
You bet.
Yeah, question to Harry, if I might. Thank you, Madam Chair. You're concerned about the point estimate and the variability around the point estimate. I have a quote. If you would describe that to me in a little more detail, if you would.
Okay.
And then a second question. Well, do that one first for me, if you would.
There are two point estimates. One is the historical method, and those are all the red dots you see up until 2010.
Right.
And I gave you what the confidence interval was around the historic estimate, and it was for 66,000 fish, it was plus 32 minus 21 to the 95% confidence interval. Okay. Then we have what's called the set line population estimate, which is a new methodology. The fish are gill netted, tagged, and then recovered in the set line. The advantage of the set line method is you get results back in a few months as opposed to 13 or 14 months that it takes to recover historic method fish in gill nets and in the sport. So the good news is you get an earlier estimate. The bad news is there's only 1 year to compare those two methodologies. And in that 1 year, there was a dramatic difference, relatively dramatic difference, between the set line estimate and the historical estimate. So, I mean, I'm a little scientist, and if you change your model, typically what you do, you'd run the two models in parallel for 5 or 10 years and try to get some profound knowledge around those two models and then select which one is right. You wouldn't change horses in the middle of the stream in year one, and that's what we're doing. And we're changing horses to the new model, which has a confidence interval of at least plus or minus 69%. That's the point estimate piece of it. What the model in Oregon does now, they take that set line estimate and they run it through their model that considers predation, an estimate of predation, and an estimate of recruitment, the numbers of legals that go into the oversize category, and harvest. We know the harvest number, okay? But the predation estimate is it's based on observations from the dam, and an estimate is how many stellars there are in a river below Camas, how many sturgeon they eat a day, and they've come up with it's 10,600 sturgeon probably killed by stellars, and 750 are oversized and 150 are brood. Now, what's the accuracy of that number? I mean, you tell me. It's got to be plus or minus 30% at least. So there's great uncertainty going into the model there. There's great uncertainty going into the model for how many recruits are coming in, and the recruit number is critical. If you don't have 40% of recruits, you probably don't have a fishery.
Okay.
And so you just I think that we've kind of had a blind spot. We have ignored the uncertainty when we've developed the harvest guidelines, and I think we have to consider that uncertainty.
Yeah. Second question: if you had your druthers, how much do you think that the exploitation rate should be reduced in order to
Let me take a crack at that. I guess as opposed to being too prescriptive, I'd say we should not go in baby steps. I've heard some rumors out of Oregon. They want to say, well, let's keep it where it is this year. The next year we'll go to 19%, and then the next year we'll go to 16%. If you look at the Sturgeon Conservation Plan, I spent 15 hours with Oregon staff and Washington staff as an advisor helping comment on that 172-page document. That clearly says about 10 times the harvest rate should be 16%. Is that enough? I don't know. A question I'd like you to ask staff would be, if we had applied a 16% harvest rate, in the last 2 years, would the population have grown or continue to have declined? I've run the numbers, and I'll tell you in my mind, my calculations say it would have continued to decline. That says to me 16% isn't enough. maybe 16% plus a 30% buffer will start to turn this thing around. But this thing is on a dramatic downward trend. And Oregon will tell you, they were quoting a paper the other day, they said, we have no conservation concern. Conservation concern is a biospeak term that I'm sure you understand. But it really has nothing to do with it has everything to do with, are the fish going to go extinct? The conservation threshold in the document is 31,000 fish. I can make a point. If you look at the last point on my graph, the green dot, which is the projection using the old historic method, we're down to 46,000 fish. If you apply confidence interval to that 46,000 fish, the conservation threshold is within that confidence interval. That should be of huge concern to everybody in this room. And I'm very concerned with people that are in the departments that are saying we don't have a conservation concern, because I think we certainly do. Just project what that line is doing.
Thank you.
Commissioner Carpenter.
Madam Chair, thank you. Well, I'm impressed with the knowledge that you folks have. It's very professionally done. Let me ask you a question based on the analysis that you've done, just straight up. Is 12% a number that works in your criteria?
I guess I'd prefer to sort of push it back at staff and say, consider everything we said here today around uncertainty. Consider the trend in addition to the point estimate. And you tell us what the percentage needs to be for you to keep your job 2 years from now. That's what I'd like to see.
Well, my point was,
that's how my world used to work.
You said to us that you did the analysis. I just was asking what your comment was back at a 12% number, just so I have a sense of what you know.
I haven't run 12%.
Okay.
And I don't have access to the sophisticated model that Oregon has, and they run all this stuff through.
Fair enough.
Commissioner Jennings.
Thank you. I just wanted to ask a couple of questions about the winter gillnet fishery that you're talking about. I mean, in the handout you gave us with the graph of the numbers, you know, winter has 55 directed sturgeon being caught as opposed to some of the other seasons, but that's such a small number. Why are you focusing so hard on eliminating the winter gillnet fishery?
I think at this point, in the situation with sturgeon, I think we would remove any impacts that... I think with the situation we have with sturgeon right now, we know we have very precipitously declining population. I think we all agree on that. And this is an impact that obviously there's a price to pay. There's no free lunches here. And this season on sturgeon itself has some kind of an impact. You're going to be handling fish that you don't keep. And in the end, it doesn't cost the commercial fishery anything. They can take that allocation. So from sturgeon alone, it just seems to me it's an impact we can get rid of. And that's just one less impact. But it also has impacts on salmon and steelhead. And it's unmonitored. We don't know what they are, but those fish are all in the steelhead that are in the river that time of year are endangered. And the steelhead that are in that time of year, for those of you who are familiar with the Lower Columbia River, many of those steelhead from those Lower Columbia River streams are not 6-pound net house summer fish. These are big, heavy-shouldered fish. Many of them go, I've caught several of them that are 23 to 25 pounds, but a lot of them are 12 to 15, 16 pounds, and they are not going to swim through a 9-inch mesh net. But I think the important point here is that we don't know. To the best of my knowledge, that fishery, that winter gillnet fishery, has never been systematically monitored. And so it just seems to us that this is an impact that will not cost anything. The commercial fishery goes ahead and they can get that allocation later in the year. In my discussions with Cindy LaFleur, I asked her to provide me the ex-vessel value that were paid to the fishermen. She provided me those costs, and it was only a few pennies difference between fish that were taken in that winter fishery and fisheries the rest of the year. So I'm sorry, that's good. I guess my long answer to your short question, but
it's a good answer,
Commissioner. Yeah, that would be our answer.
I got to remind everyone we still have a lot of people to hear from. Commissioner Schmidt.
Thank you, Chair. I'll be brief. I'm always impressed with the professionalism that you bring to the table, and I appreciate it very much. I think we've shown two previous years you've been here a responsiveness. I mean, we did the 40%. We did the 30%. We were told that would get a stop to the decline. It hasn't done that. We're now, to use your words, Harry, baby steps won't do it any longer. Are we approaching the point where we should simply shut it down? a moratorium?
Are you asking?
I'm asking you, what do you think about that? Harry or you, either one of you.
We have a number of members that would have suggested that, certainly, and I guess we don't have an official position on that. I just think we can't continue to take baby steps or this thing's going to keep right on sliding. You know, commercials are going to lose. We're all going to lose. From an economic standpoint, this fishery has gone from being a $15 million a year sport fishery to about a $5 million a year sport fishery, just because the number of days on the river has declined so dramatically.
And if I could add a point to that that I think is relevant, and that is that we have rather than looking like it's a competition between the two user groups here, the recreational community, if we look at these reductions over the last few years, look at the reductions the recreational community has already taken. And so point being is we're willing to take, and what I hear from the recreational community is, no, we don't want to give up our fishing days, but we will. And we'll continue to, because we're looking down the line, and if we don't reverse this, there's going to be nothing to fish for, and nobody's going to be fishing. So, anyway.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Chuck Tracy?
Thank you, Madam Chairman, Commissioners. Good afternoon. My name is Chuck Tracy, and I'm here to request you modify your special hunt permit process. The recent change in the program allowing points to accrue for multiple permits was a vast improvement over the previous system. It provides more opportunity for hunters and more flexibility. It's also provided benefit to the department, both in terms of immediate revenue generation and also improvement in stakeholder interest and satisfaction, which should pay off in long-term support for the department. However, one aspect of the current program should be changed. The requirement that if two permits are drawn in a given year, that the hunter would have to forfeit one of those permits. He can only harvest one animal a year, which I agree with, but would have to forfeit that other permit that he drew and forfeit the accrued points that may have worked a long time or saved a long time to utilize. So, and this seems counter to the primary benefit of the program from the hunter's perspective. So in order to avoid the potential loss of accrued points, the hunters may have to make choices about when or who they hunt with. I've hunted elk with the same partner for 25 years. But in the last couple of years, I've been trying to get my teenage son involved in big game hunting. He's yet to take a deer. I haven't started him elk hunting yet, but he's been collecting his points. And I think it's important that he have some success in big game hunting in order to maintain his interest. And in order to do that, I'm considering, you know, I would have him apply as a partner with me so he can utilize my larger number of points. And I think we have a reasonably good chance of drawing a cow tag under that, which would be a great thing. But for me, it's really come down to a choice of doing that or applying for a bull permit with my longtime partner. So that's a choice that I'll have to make, and I'll have to make with my partner about how we handle that. But I think it's possible to inject some flexibility into the process. So that some of those choices could be more palatable. For example, if I were drawn for both a cow and a bull permit, but I could opt out of one, then I'd be willing to apply for both in 1 year. And then if I did draw two, then I'd have to give one up. But if I was drawn for the bull tag, my son wasn't drawn for a cow tag, then my partner and I could go ahead and hunt. So I think with that, I'd be able to take advantage of more hunting opportunities and more permits. So I'm here to ask the Commission consider implementing a system whereby successful permit applicants could opt out of permit with some specified time after the drawing and retain their accrued points. Of course, there would be a fee that you could charge. And the permits, the unclaimed permits, could be reissued in a raffle, which would generate more revenue for the department.
Okay, so your time is up.
Okay, well, I would point out that you do have my letter I would encourage you to read it so you could get the rest of my testimony in front of you and consider that under your next agenda item.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mike Bachman and Kent Martin, want to come up? Yep.
Hi, I'm Mike Bachman, commercial fisherman. I'd like to see a show of hands if any of you guys are commercial fishermen or have been or worked on a boat. All right, so there's a few. Thank you. The sturgeon season, we're allowed a certain amount of fish. Now, they were able to tell you exactly how many we caught. We caught 55 fish. That's pretty nice to have those, that you can see that number. I mean, the difference between catching fish in the winter time, we get paid when we go fishing. In other words, there's no fishing now. Some of those guys might catch a couple of fish to make a few bucks to help get their license, to help repay for their license, you know, after they renew their license. That money helps them during that time. Yeah, you could get it all in September, but then you only get your money in September. It's nice to have your money come out. We're not all so lucky to have a job that pays you every month like clockwork, like some people. You know, we got to go fishing to make our money, and there's a long time between December and September. And it'd be nice to have some of that money during the winter time to pay your light bill or property tax or whatever else that, you know, that they have to do with the money that they make. Secondly, you're allowed a certain amount of fish anyway. So if we're only going to catch our right amount of fish, what difference does it make to you either? As long as we're not catching more fish, we're catching the same amount of fish. We're not saying, can we catch these fish plus that much more during September? It's the exact same amount. And they know what we got. You're not holding the sports to that type of regimen. You don't even know what they caught. You couldn't say what they caught, when they caught it, how they handled it, or nothing. They have no information saying how many fish they caught. You don't know if they caught a thing yesterday or not. How many people were out there? How many they caught? You have no clue. For us, you know exactly where they were caught, who caught them, and how big they were. Right down to how much those fish weighed. So you know, on average, if you caught big fish or little fish, where they were caught, what district, you know, what area they were caught. There's just, when they talk about the word conservation, it means to save, or not just to take it from somebody else. How can they say that they're here to conservate when all they're doing, when they just say, hey, stop that guy, he's getting 20%, when we're supposed to be getting half? And I think you guys failed us on that. I don't know, I guess there's a lot of fishermen here, but yet I don't recognize any of you from fishing. I'd like to see some real fishermen there, people that actually fish that we see. Who can, you know, I mean, yeah, you might have fished a long time ago, or you might have fished someplace else. But we'd like to see some people there that we know, at least one or two out of this group, that was actual fishermen, that we say, hey, we see you out there, and we know that you know what's going on with the fishery. And because it doesn't seem like we're getting a fair shake here.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, John McKinley, come forward. Mr. Martin?
Thank you, Commissioners. My name is Kent Martin, commercial fisherman from Skamakaway, Washington. There seems, I think you have my presentation there, there seems to be some questions raised about our winter gillnet fishery. While we realize catches were low in 2011, we would remind you that catches can be highly variable in the lower Columbia, do I suspect, to smelt abundance and timing. The 2000 and 2009 average was just under 1,600 fish. I think we'd like to maintain the status quo within our general allocation. We would point you toward studies of the past 2 years that have shown no mortalities from sturgeon taken from gillnets and held for 48 hours. In fact, the states have used gillnets for test fishing and tagging for clear back to the mid-80s, 25 or 30 years. You will see, however, in the enclosed chart that from 2004 to 2009, nearly one adult sturgeon in five was carrying recreational fishing tackle inside it or bore evidence of severe hook damage. There is a major and profound difference between a commercial fishery that handles an occasional over-length sturgeon and a sport fishery that has targeted those same fish for a recreational experience. With regard to steelhead handle, there are decades of data with regard to the ability of large mesh gill nets to pass steelhead. The latest studies, which I have here, are out of Oregon, and the numbers were even small. In fact, they were having trouble finding a baseline because the numbers were so low in terms of our interaction. With regard to spring Chinook, we have a sport fishery that in 2011 harvested 40,000 Chinook and Jacks. They released or discarded, if you want to use CCA's word, around 7,000 unmarked Chinook. All the information was provided strictly on a voluntary he said, she said reporting basis. Now these same people are raising red flags over 88 spring Chinook. So I have a couple recommendations. We need a much more rigorous catch monitoring system developed for the group that is currently harvesting 80% of the sturgeon and 80% of the spring Chinook. If conservation and harvest reform are truly issues here, then we should institute or seriously contemplate barbless hooks for spring Chinook and circle hooks for sturgeon. I would recommend, or we would recommend, that the main stem Columbia should be closed for recreational fishing for salmonids during the months of November and December, when most of what is present is present to natural spawn, listed ESA coho, chum, also listed, including some main stem spawners, and natural spawn winter steelhead. Fisheries targeting low levels of hatchery returning fish at this time could easily take place in the tribs. And finally, the commission needs to start looking at the issue of recreational double dipping, i.e. buying licenses in both states and filling out two sturgeon cards. We got rid of that crap about 10 years ago when guys had multiple licenses. Only one card, one license, one allocation. And I don't have any problem if you want to drop the exploitation rate. It's up to me what the scientists and the staff feels comfortable with.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bruce Cruikshank, would you come up, please? Mr. McKinley?
Yeah, I'm John McKinley. I'm a commercial fisherman. I'm on the commercial advisory group. There's a board of us. We have multiple annual meetings, get together and decide what to do with our particular allocation of fish, how to split it up during the year. And I also have participated in quite a bit of this new selective harvest study in the fall, the catch and release and fish, and the modified purse seine, beach seining, that type of stuff. But anyway, we have an 80% sport split on these sturgeon, meaning we get 20% of those. Now a few years ago there was an annual amount of sturgeon on the Columbia to be harvested, and that number was 40,000. At that time, that meant 32,000 of those fish were being harvested by sport, and 8,000 of those fish were being harvested by commercial. And now we've taken that 40,000 number, and I believe that's been cut down to about 17,000 now annual harvest. So I'm concerned about these stocks also. But it appears to me that this group is trying to put all the burden of conservation on the commercial fishery, who's taken 20% of these fish just by taking away our sturgeon fishery. We do this for a living. We need to generate money to renew our permits. I actually own an out-of-state permit. I actually have an Oregon gillnet license. I pay almost $2,000 a year to renew that gillnet permit. It's pretty crazy. I have some of my own suggestions on maybe some things we could do to possibly take a look at some of these sturgeon stocks and how to maybe help them out. I've made some of these suggestions before to the departments, but nobody seems to want to listen, and I would think enhancing some sturgeon and actually getting together with the sport fishery, get the commercials and the sports together and figure out a way to raise some of these sturgeon when these sea lions are taking those big oversized spawners out of the population. That's a long-term effect that my children are going to have to pay for. I don't have a written out speech and a bunch of graphs and stuff for you guys today. I think we all need to do our part, and I don't think that it should all be pointed on the commercial fishery. I really don't. And appreciate you guys listening to me today. I also want to support the guys here that come up and talk about the hunting stuff. I wish I had more time to come here and talk about that type of stuff, and I don't. I'm coming here to try to fight for what I do for a living, and I appreciate you guys listening to me, and I'd be more than happy to answer any questions. Raleigh, I actually kind of liked your comment. If we're gonna really get concerned about the conservation here, maybe we do need to look at actually kind of stopping it and shutting it down for everybody, not just put the burden on the commercials. Not that I want it to go away, but maybe that's something we need to look at.
Commissioner Schmidt.
Thanks, Chair. And John, I have a couple questions about your fishery. Why is it that you don't have live boxes in the winter fishery? And I honestly don't know that, but you have it in all the other times, and they're proven very successful.
You know, that is a very good question, and I'm not going to jump in and answer that. That is an excellent question. I wish you would actually maybe ask that to somebody like Kent or something that has a little more knowledge in that particular piece, but I believe it's because of the mortality rate with that particular mesh size that we're fishing that time of year. We just live with that mortality rate. Now, that would be a good question for one of the state employees, Cindy LaFleur or somebody, to run that by someone like that. I apologize for not having the answer.
I will see Kent, because he is kind of the dean of your group. The second point, I just wanted to know if this is accurate. The information I have here states that the majority of the Chinook harvested during the winter sturgeon-directed season occurs in the final period or week of the season. Is that accurate?
You know, I think it's possible that maybe could you run that, the majority of the sturgeon or the majority of the salmon? Of the sturgeon?
Winter sturgeon fishery.
Oh, you know, it's spread out, and it's so different year to year. Water conditions, it's just so different from year to year. These 55, 85 numbers, I mean, that's something somebody pulled out from last year. I'm sure it's accurate, but this is not how it works every year. And like one guy commented, we need our money throughout the year. We can't just wait 6 months down the road to get a paycheck to still survive. I mean, that's not how our life works. So I hope that answers your question.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bryce Devine, would you come forward, please? Mr. Crookshanks?
Madam Chairman, Commissioners, my name is Bruce Crookshanks. I serve on the Washington Commercial Advisory Panel, and I've worked extensively with the Department of Oregon and Washington for 30-some years. And the staff has been working their tails off trying to come up with a solution. We've identified a problem, and we're working on it. We have a plan. We have an agreement, and the agreement is for a 22% exploitation rate through the year 2013. In 2014, Oregon has come up with a plan to rebuild the stocks according to their modeling. Now, this has taken a great deal of scientific endeavor to come up with this. Some of the people that have spoken prior to my comments seem to ignore or are just not informed on what's really going on. But the exploitation rate is at 2014 is to go to 16%, and that provides not just to hold it, but to rebuild it. And they're very confident in their data, scientific data, that this will accomplish it. Now, if we get down the road and it doesn't, well, then I'm sure that the staffs will be watching it and getting in tune with it. But you're allowing a 360-day sport fishery on sturgeon. They talk about us handling sturgeon. We do not impact those sturgeon with a 9-inch gear. We don't even impact them with a 5-inch net. They swim away. I get a big one in there, I cut the net, and I let them out. There's no other way to handle them. You just simply have to cut the net and let them through on a small mesh. And the big ones on a big mesh. You can't deal with them. You can't bring them in the boat. You simply cut the net and let them out. There's no other way to release them. And everybody does that because they don't want to deal with it. You know, and that's the only way you can deal with it. And they swim away. They're not damaged. But they continually hook these oversized fish with hook and line over and over, which has been proven scientifically to damage their reproductive process because they're continually stressed. Now, we're not continually stressing them. We're stressing them for a short period of time. And you call a couple of 9-hour fishing periods in the fall
stress, then what are 360 days of stress with a sport fishing? So therefore, we support the staff proposal. It's in place, it's scientifically managed to the best of our ability, and that's what I think we should go with. Mr. Wickersham is totally uninformed when he makes statements about our stressing these gill net and these steelhead. We have been studied to death. We have volunteers in our boat all summer or all spring salmon every time. I take observers every day. I've had law enforcement jump on a boat and they seem disappointed when they find out I got an observer on the boat. I want to see some observers on these sport boats and some of these guide boats. How about some of them getting the spotlight turned on them? You know what we do. We have nothing to hide. And this malarkey about day or night has nothing to do with it. We have to catch Chinook at night. That's just the way it is.
Thank you. Thank you. Terry Osling, would you come forward? Okay, Mr. Devine.
Good morning, or good afternoon, Chairman Wecker and Commission. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. And I feel like I've been here before. In fact, it was last January, and my testimony is probably pretty close to the same. My reason for being here is that I'm a commercial fisherman, and we come up here, and the CCA is usually here as well, and they want to impose their brand of conservation, which is the gillnet fishermen are going to do it all. And if you look at what we have here with this winter fishery, they have 55 sturgeon and 88 spring or chinook. That seems to me would be the measure that would get the least bang for the buck if your objective was to conserve these fish. And as Bruce mentioned, there's a year-round sport fishery, and last winter about this time I was watching GPS Northwest in Portland, and they were bragging up the catch and release sturgeon fishery in the Willamette. And of course, is there accountability in that? I don't know. I don't see it. I'm very concerned about this stock, and I think that we, most of us, would be very willing to go along whatever you do as long as we're not singled out to bear the burden of it. So I'll cut her short. That's what I have to say, and thank you very much.
Thank you. Brian Stanley, would you come forward? Okay, Mr. Osling.
Hi, Terry Osling, commercial fisherman. The point of having the sturgeon more spread out is that we represent the general public, for the public has access to the fish, like the poor elderly gentleman that can't go sport fishing or things like that. And the last that I recall, the sports fishermen represented 12% of the population, but maybe it's 15. That still means we're representing 85% of the rest of the other public who doesn't sport fish, who doesn't have the time to get out there and get their own fish. And why should they have to wait until we get it in later months instead of be able to spread it out where they can have it fresh at different times of the year? Why should they have to suffer and only be able to wait and say that, well, you can't get these other 55 fish till August? Now, you get all your fish in August, then they're going to have to be froze, and the general public will get a little bit of it fresh, but why not keep it the way it is, where it's spread out more, where the general public, who we represent, for they can get what they want to eat, can have it fresh instead of be frozen. You know, that's who we're out fishing for, as we do it for a living, and we supply the general public. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Eddie Kahanka. I don't know if I'm pronouncing your name right.
I'm Brian Stanley, commercial fisherman, Kathleen, Washington. And I'm fairly new with the, not fairly new, but I just recently bought in on the Columbia River. I'm deep rooted in that area, and I'm participating in a lot of other commercial fisheries. And the one thing that I wanted to bring up is the whole conservation. You know, there's areas where I fish where if an interception or harvesting in one area was affecting another area, they would move a boundary line. You know, they basically put a freeze in a certain area. And you know, I would be in favor of freezing out the whole sturgeon harvest for a predetermined time, not eliminate, freeze, you know, for research and rebuilding a stock. And maybe analyze what methods are being used for determining the number of harvestable sturgeon. And the second thing is I have a question of where did the 80-20% harvest allocation come from, and why is it so lopsided?
This is not an opportunity to question the commission. This is an opportunity to make comments.
Okay. Well, that's my comment. Just food for thought. Next thing is, right now the winter fishery, the 9-inch is in a sense a select harvest, you know, because the small sturgeon aren't getting hung up in it. And you know, another thing to think about is a hook selective. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we have Greg Johnson is the last person who's signed up. Mr. Kahanka, is that how you pronounce your name?
Kahanka.
Kahanka.
Eddie Kahanka, and I've hunted elk in Yakima for 52 years. And I'm concerned about our future hunting for the younger generation. We've hunted the Bethel area for 53 years, and we went from 100 antlerless permits to 5 last year. And I called the game department, or I called the biologist in Yakima and talked to him, and he told me that the reason they can't give us any cow permits is the Native Indians are up there hunting. And there's got to be something done about that, because I've talked to so many hunters that are thinking about quitting hunting in this state on account of that. And it's real bad up there in Yakima. I guess you guys should know that. And I'm concerned about our young generation. I don't have that much more time to hunt. But our young generation, there's not going to be no elk hunting. Just last fall come out, and then American natives got a thing. Our Muckleshoots hunted in that, our ancestors hunted in that area, so we can hunt there. And a judge gave them the right. And I think we need to put a stop to some of that. I believe they can let them hunt without a hunting license or whatever, but let them hunt during the regular seasons, but not the way they do all summer long and in the wintertime and anytime they want to hunt. Okay.
Thank you.
That's all I got, and thanks.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson?
Good afternoon, Chairman. My name is Greg Johnson. I'm a Columbia River commercial fisherman, also fish in Alaska, and I'm a participant in the new gear study, the sainting down in the Columbia. I'm also a participant in the advisory board process. Thank you. Well, the value of these, my concern with the proposed regulation changes to our fishery by the sport groups is it seems to me that a little bit of the low-hanging fruit here. Let's grab the easy thing to grab, and that's an allocative thing as opposed to a conservation thing. And I guess I'll start off by saying that these small fisheries, like that one, we have them all over through our fishery, the end of the fall fishery, when not too many participants are there, but yet we've got this product, and we're trying to drive the market. Unlike, you know, in Alaska, you'll catch a tremendous amount of fish, and you take what you get. In this fishery, we constantly work together to try to drive the price up. Otherwise, we have nothing, because 10 years ago we were fishing for fall chinook for 35 cents a pound, and now we're at 235. A part of that is just general market improvement, but a great deal of it is going to small buyers like Robert Sudar, who's testified numerous times in front of you. He's somebody who helps drive our price up. Numerous guys like that, we get a little bit of product multiple times throughout the year, And those guys are out there selling to the high-end guys, and that's driving the supply and demand deal in our fishery. And it's very important, because if this thing were to return to 35 cents a pound in the fall, or $1.25 for sturgeon, then we just can't make it. And you've asked us with your last decision on spring Chinook, you allocated a great deal towards the sport fishery. And I'm not here to complain about that, but that was a significant cut to our fishery. So the only thing we can do to work to our benefit is to keep driving that price. For example, I sold. I didn't fish much in this winter fishery last year. I caught three sturgeon and three salmon. I got $12 a pound for those salmon. They were about 21 pounds. So, I mean, that little bit of fish was almost $1,000. How critical is that to my full year? It's not. But these little pieces all along the way are. And so that. And so if this is the first step, they take a little bit of October because it'll be easy hanging. And then this little one here, that's my concern, is step by step by step. In terms of conservation, we sat in our advisory group and supported the staff's recommendations on the sturgeon conservation. I personally was the guy in there that supported the lowest number possible. I think we should take the most conservative approach possible towards these fish at an 80-20 view.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, that concludes the open public input. We're about 40 minutes behind schedule. Thank you all. You did an excellent job representing your views. You're welcome to stay and listen to the briefings ahead. We have inadvertently omitted scheduling in a break this afternoon, so I'll just insert a break probably after the next briefing, because the next one is also a public hearing as well.